Hi, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Chris.
We've been covering very, very carefully the chapter, Working with Others, as it's outlined in the original manuscript. There's some changes in the original manuscript that I kind of think are interesting, and you know we're covering those as we go. But you know what really has dawned on me with a thorough examination of this particular chapter is it's teaching us and telling us exactly how to do a 12-step call. It leaves no room for maneuverability, really. Alcoholics Anonymous has gotten loose about the 12-step call thing. For the most part, what we do today is we let people find us. And in the early days, when you're reading this chapter, they very much went out and found alcoholics. They searched them out, and then they did what is laid out in this chapter as a 12-step call. And when they were, during the periods of time when they were doing that, Alcoholics Anonymous grew exponentially. It grew, and if you look at our statistics over the last 20, 30 years, we really haven't grown. We've kind of plateaued. We're somewhere between 2 million and, worldwide membership. Maybe a new census will change that. But I think we've backed away a lot from what it asks us to do in here. It's telling us to go find people who might need this thing, and to lay out a process for them whereby they can get engaged in the recovery process. The last several weeks we were basically talking about the first visit, the first time we see somebody who could be a prospect for Alcoholics Anonymous, and it tells us exactly what to do. We are to tell them part of our story. We're to talk specifically about how powerlessness shows up in our life, how the allergy of the body affects us, how the obsession of the mind affects us, how baffled we were, how we couldn't understand why we couldn't stop drinking. Depending on what type of person we're talking to, we're supposed to kind of mold our talk so that they can better relate to it. And then we're supposed to outline the course of action that we took that brought about recovery from alcoholism. This is what we're supposed to do. We're also supposed to leave them the big book, have them read it, and the next time we talk to them, we are to ask them, are you ready? Are you ready to go through with this program of recovery? Now, I got to tell you, there's not a whole lot of people in AA that do it that way anymore. We grab people, we bring them to meetings, we introduce them to our friends, and I truly believe that there's an enormous amount of value in looking at what it's asking us to do here. We're laying out what alcoholism is, and we're laying out what recovery from alcoholism is going to consist of, and then we're asking them, do you want this thing? That's a pretty good way to handle this. In my first couple of years at AA, I was about throwing them in the car and getting them to meetings and, hoping that they're going to love the fellowship so much that they're just going to, they're just going to jump in. Today I look back on it, and I did those people no great service. Most of them are not around anymore. However, the people who've gone through the steps with me, they're around. A huge majority of those people, I know exactly where they are today. So we've been talking about the first visit. We'll pick it up. This is page 44 in the original manuscript. I don't know what that translates to in anything else. But it says, suppose now you are making your second visit to a man. He has read this volume and says he is prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. He's willing to go through. He's read the book Alcoholics Anonymous. He understands that the recovery process is in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. He's read it, and he's made a decision to go ahead. Let's move forward. Now, folks, there's going to be people that don't even read the book. Then there's going to be people that maybe read the book and think it's, I don't really need to do that. And in the early days, there was kind of a hard and fast way that they handled this, which is basically, you know what we are now. You know what alcoholism is. You know what the recovery process is. You've read the book. You know, when you're willing to work with us, we will do anything we can to help. See you later. You know? Having had the experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. Having had what experience? The experience of the recovery process, going through the steps. Suggest he make his decision with you and tell you his story, but do not insist upon it if he prefers to consult someone else. You know, what decision? The decision to go through with this program of action and the decision to turn their will and their life over to the care of God. Are they ready to do that? And, you know, in the early days, Dr. Bob was great at not really playing around. You really needed to convince him that you wanted a relationship with God. And he was I don't know if Bill Wilson was as finicky about it, but certainly Dr. Bob was. He may be broke or homeless. If he is, try to help him about getting a job. I've done that plenty of times. Sometimes it's been good. Sometimes it was an absolute debacle. Give him a little financial assistance, unless it would deprive your family or creditors of money they should have. You know, we're talking back in the Depression, and, you know, we're talking what they would do back in the day was not a whole hell of a lot. But there were times when they would front the cost of detoxing. They would front the cost of detoxing, and they would vouch for the person, and then that person would be put into their care after their hospitalization for their befoggedness. Perhaps you will want to take the man into your home for a few days. But be sure you use discretion. Be certain he will be welcomed by your family, and that he's not trying to pose upon you for money, connections, or shelter. Permit that, and you only harm him. You know, that really is pretty powerful, and I've thought a lot about that sentence. We'll do anything we can for the person if we're really convinced that they're sincere and they really want to get help. But there are people who just want to roll with, you know, the treatment center, or they want to roll with the detox or the halfway house, or go from one program to another homeless program to another homeless program. This book is saying if you allow that, you're harming the individual to allow them to roll like that. What they would do is they would want to be absolutely sure that someone was sincere, that they really wanted help, that they really wanted to live a spiritual life and they wanted to recover from alcoholism. You know, not everybody that shows up in Alcoholics Anonymous is willing to do that. Certainly not everybody that shows up in treatment or halfway houses or detoxes are willing to do what they need to do to recover. And this is basically saying that you permit that and you only harm him. And I've seen that from my own experience. I do a lot of work with treatment centers. I do a lot of work with halfway houses. And and I've got to agree. All you're doing is helping somebody kick the can down the road. If you're going to let them stay with you and be part of your program, and they're not willing to do what they need to do. You'll be making it possible for him to be insincere. You will be aiding in his destruction rather than his recovery. Never avoid these responsibilities, but be sure you are doing the right thing if you assume them. Self-sacrifice for others is the foundation stone of your recovery. A kindly act once in a while isn't enough. You have to act a good Samaritan every day, if need be. It may mean the loss of many nights' sleep, great interference with your pleasures, interruptions to your business. It may mean sharing your money in your home, counseling frantic wives and relatives, innumerable trips to police courts, sanitariums, hospitals, jails, and asylums. Your telephone may jangle at any time of the day or night. Your wife will sometimes say that she is neglected. A drunk may trash the furniture in your home or burn a mattress.
I hate that's the selling point for me. I want to sign up right there.
I know. You just have to have extra
flaming mattresses.
Have
what
have
I go
extra
for.
Mattresses. You may have to fight with him if he is violent. The martial arts is always something that's good to prepare yourself in case you've got to lump up a drunk. You know, because Dave, some people need a meeting.
Some people need a beating.
Sometimes you'll have to call a doctor and administer sedatives under his direction. This is one thing I just don't do. I had a bad experience administering sedatives. So I really try not to do that. Another time you may have to send for the police or an ambulance. So they're warning us. Look, this is real work, you know. It's gonna be inconvenient. But we're going to need to do it. People's lives are at stake. And nothing will so much ensure our immunity from drink as intensive work with other alcoholics. And this is what the intensive work with other alcoholics looks like.
Hi, everyone. My name is David Palmer. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. Chris does such a wonderful job of kind of dissecting and talking about what it used to be like and... You know, people would roll into Dr. Bob's, where Dr. Bob was a doctor, and go to knock on his door, and he'd have one of those wooden doors with the glass painted in, and it'd say, Dr., Robert Holbrook Smith, proctologist. Well, this is a new fix for what ails me, right? I'm going to roll into there.
I haven't tried that yet.
Yeah, I haven't tried that one yet. and how they did it back then, and he pretty elegantly talked about how things have changed, we're so fortunate to be living at the time that we do. I know that at any given time, there's a half a dozen people in this room right now who I'd be happy to sit down with and give a fifth step to, because I know that their hearts are full of compassion, love, and tolerance. The last fifth step I did with 7, but I might be wrong. It might have been 5, but 3 men and 2 women, because the book talks about the people the persons are person who are going to hear our inventory. And looking around at the landscape of individuals that are available to us in these rooms today, we can find somebody who is an old school. Dr. Bob kind of guy, and will take us through the steps, relatively authoritatively, relatively quickly, and have us on our knees real quick, and have us write an inventory real quick, or we can come up against somebody who is, somewhat theoretical. And it's always kind of who I come up across, right, that has that moment, right? I mean, I can come up and speak to Bill one day, and Bill's in a certain place, and it's very attractive for me to talk to him about what's going on with me, and that's it. Right, that's the moment with God where two people connect. That's that moment where things make sense to do. That's that moment where, like, yeah, I can do this. And there's been other times in my recovery where I was like, I had no idea who I was supposed to be talking to. None whatsoever. And then the guy walks in the room and he looks good, right? he's got a nice suit on. You know, he drives a nice car. He looks less insane than I am. You know, and I just, you know, I want that, right? I want that. You know, in the early days, it was a level of desperation. You know, if you had rolled up on me and said, "Hey, Dave, you know, we got this thing with God," I'd be like, "Thanks very much," right? Until I was desperate enough. Until I was desperate enough, then I would listen to anybody, right? And that's the thing, the bench, you know, that mark was set so low in the early days. You know, Bill Dotson, what was it, 7 times he had been out of the hospital before they rolled up on him? Some number, I mean, like in the last year he had been in and out of the hospital and he had gotten drunk 3 times, the last 3 times on the way home. And he didn't want it, you know, I mean, not that he didn't want recovery, he didn't want to live that way. You know, in the final days of my drinking, my act of drinking, I didn't want to live that way, right? My entire life was like a bad episode, you know, of some, you know, of like, I don't know, you picked a series, you know, it was bad, you know, and I knew that there were no lies left. Have you ever been to that place where there are no lies left? Where even you can't lie to yourself anymore? Where you go, you know, I think it's not their fault. It's just not their fault. You know, but if I hadn't, if you had that, you'd squander it and then you'd be right back where you are now. You know, and isn't that the thing that I'm looking for when I roll up on you? There may be a time, there has been times in my life when I rolled up on Chris, you know, it was my second time in recovery and If you took an inventory of my life, it looked pretty good. You know, I was unhappily married, and I had I had money in the bank, and owned a couple of homes, and I was out sponsoring a bunch of people, and I was running around, and I was speaking in AA, and I was involved with this, and I was involved with that, and I had no God, right? But I wouldn't have put that down on the inventory. And this guy shows up and was happy where he was at. Right? Happy where he was at. So this is like one of the great things about Alcoholics Anonymous today is we don't have to go grab that first alcoholic that we find, right, who came through the door of the hospital and pitched us maybe at the wrong time or we weren't willing to hear it. Right? I can't tell you how many times people told me before I came in the first time, you know, Dave, it started out this way, you might have a drinking problem. Not me, I'm just having fun. Right? To, you've got a serious drinking problem, you know, in the end. Like, what is wrong with you? You know, you're yellow like a school bus from the hepatitis. You know, you're losing control of your bodily functions at, you know, awkward times, at family functions. I mean, this is just not what we call fun anymore. You know, to, you know, having been given the gift of a separation from that entire life and, you know, 11 years in, like, not going to meetings anymore. People going, why aren't you going to meetings anymore? You know, I've evolved was my response, right? Didn't work out that good, in case you're wondering. But, you know, this whole kind of idea, I was unwilling to hear the gentle persuasions of others. I had to be locked up the first time. And then I had to be presented with something that I didn't want to see happen at the time, which was a divorce. And I said, what can I do? And she said, you know, graciously, she said, why don't you try AA again? And I roll back in here. My point about this whole kind of, like, drift is that we live in this kind of graceful time where if we just put a little bit of effort into our lives, whether you have 9 hours, right, 9 months, 9 years, it doesn't matter. You can kind of reach out to people, starting with your very first meeting, and say, you know, I'm looking for something. I don't even know what it is. And have somebody take you out for bad eggs and tepid coffee, you know, which is a hell of a gift. It's possible, and then to wend your way through all the different people that are here in Alcoholics Anonymous and to find out what truth is, right? This whole thing is about finding truth, right? When all the lies were gone in the end, right, when I was a wet alcoholic, I really was kind of faced with no choice. Anything was better. Anything was better. When I was a dry, you know, brittle, burnt out, non-drinking alcoholic, I had the same problem. I had run out of lies because I knew I had caused all my problems, right? I knew every problem that I had that day when the ex-wife wanted to become an ex-wife was of my own making. You know, truth is elegant because it doesn't change, it doesn't go away. The only thing that happens is I decide not to look at it, or I paint it with a brush of some other color. Truth is invariant. It is right there. It's inviolable. It doesn't change. My acceptance of it and my rejection of it doesn't even matter. Truth is as solid as anything ever. So when that guy comes to the foot of, you know, when Bill and Dr. Bob show up at the foot of Bill Dotson's bed, he's waiting to hear something, right? He's waiting to hear something. He didn't want to drink the last three times leaving the hospital. He says that in his story. He says that in other material that you can read on Bill Dotson, you know. I didn't want to go back to the life I was living when I was a wet alcoholic and someone made the presentation. It took me 6 weeks before someone actually rolled up on me and told, you know, and 12-stepped me in the rehab he worked there. Told me about being a bike. I mean, you know, and it shocked me because this guy was, you know, his fingernails were cut and clean. His hair was clean. His beard was trimmed. He was wearing the, you know, he had the same kind of socks on both feet, right? I mean, these are things I couldn't really kind of wrap my hands around. And but he told me a story of redemption through the 12 steps and of getting free. And he had 2 years of sobriety, still sober to this day. And I still speak to him. You know, the funny thing was, 2 weeks after he 12-stepped me, and I finally thought maybe I can actually get this, one of the counselors there died of a drug overdose. Mm-hmm. He had been clean and sober for 2 years. We don't know what I need, right? I don't know. You know, I was in prayer and meditation on the train one time, and I was always asked, who am I supposed to be helpful today? And this guy, Dave's name came up, and I was like, he seems to be pretty spiritually centered. I wonder how I could help him. The next day on the train, when I went into prayer and meditation again, Dave's name came up. I go, well, God, what do you want me to do? And he goes, ask him to take you through the steps. I said, oh, Christ, I'm better than him. Why would I ask him? I mean, that's the answer, right? That I'm thinking I'm better than him. Spiritually better. How does that even work, right? And, you know, I asked him to take me through the steps. I didn't know where I was until I actually went into prayer and meditation. I didn't know what was available to me until I sat before another individual and asked him to take me through the steps. This thing about working with others, this idea that I'm going to show up and somehow be useful to you is solely, at this point in my life, when I'm rolling up on somebody and I'm talking to them, I'm all about exposing the delusion, right? How many people here today were upset at somebody else? Right? You're just upset for a while at somebody else, for momentary. I mean, I know I was, right? Somebody didn't treat me fairly. Didn't handle my, you know, grading of a test properly, according to me. I don't even have my college degree yet. But this idea that things are wrong about me is a refutation of the idea that God's got this, right? And in my place where I am when I roll in on day one is that everything's wrong. But if I'm going to be actually ready to hear the truth, I got to know that I've run out of lies, right? They've got to have gone their own separate way from me. I've got to have no friendly direction to turn to. Because I'll turn to that direction long before I'll turn to the idea of getting with God through the 12 steps.
Right.
Moving right along. I like the flaming mattresses, though. That's something that's always kind of got my eye.
You might have to fight with them.
I might have to fight with them, yeah. This sort of thing goes on constantly, but we seldom allow an alcoholic to live in our homes for long at a time. It's not good for him, and it sometimes creates serious complications in a family. Though an alcoholic does not respond, there is no reason why you should neglect his family. You should continue to be friendly to them in every way. The family should be offered your way of life, should they accept, and practice spiritual principles. There is much better chance the head of the family will recover. And even though he continues to drink, the family will find life more bearable. I had a great experience with a guy. I started working with him, and he lived out in California. And after we got through the amends process, I went out to California to visit him, and I became very friendly with his family. Right, and it was really kind of very cool. Right, I would speak to his daughter. His daughter was in her 20s, I speak to the daughter on the phone sometimes. I speak to the wife on the phone sometimes, you know. And we would talk about the spiritual process. They had their own spiritual process in place. And it was really very cool. And then one day the guy drank. Right? One day the guy drank. And I kept talking to the family for a while, and then all of a sudden, you know, they wanted to end the conversations. Right? Because they saw that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work for him. Right? They liked me, but it didn't work for him, and it was time. Right? They had just kind of time. And as far as I was concerned, okay. Who am I to impose myself on somebody else? Even with the family, it's good to leave it for another opportunity if that so happens, right? For the type of alcoholic who is able and willing to get well, little charity in the ordinary sense of the word is needed or wanted. The men who cry for money and shelter before conquering alcohol are on the wrong track. Yet we do go to great extremes to provide each other with these very things when such action is warranted. This may seem inconsistent, but it is not. It is not the matter of giving that is in question, but when and how to give. I have to tell you something. One of the things that I've always had to work on, and I work on to this day, is, am I doing this for them, or am I doing this for some aspect of me? Right? Is some part of my ego involved in this decision to help somebody else? Right? Am I trying to look better as Dave? Right? Am I trying to get out of something else? Oh, you know, I got to work with an alcoholic today. I'll see you later. I'm not going to mow the lawn. You know, what am I doing? What is the motivation behind the idea that I'm to be of service to God and my fellow man? And I awkwardly have found that, you know, probably in the last 3 or 4 years of looking at this particular thing, which came out of an inventory, that I more often than I'd like to admit, I'm doing it for selfish reasons. Right? I have found it very hard to be truly altruistic. You know, I'm not spiritually pure like Chris. And or Bill, you know, but it's funny, you know, the idea that I became it took literally until I was about 11 or 12 years sober before I started going, maybe I'm not doing this for the right reason. Maybe what's happening is that I'm actually reaching out and trying to feel better or look better about myself. And the funny thing was, a lot of stuff changed after I started looking at that in that respect. I started to act more in line with what came back in prayer and meditation, as opposed to what I thought I was supposed to be doing. The minute we put our work on a social service plane, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God. He clamors for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for. Nonsense. Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn this truth. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking alcohol so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence on God.
As the years go by, I just find more and more relevance and truth in what they're saying here. And I, you know, I'm looking at all the people that I've worked with or tried to help over the years, and this really is true. I can't. One of the things my wife and I do, it's kind of happened organically, but what we do is we navigate people into treatment. At least 2 people a week we're putting in a treatment center somewhere in America, because we've got connections and that people know to give us a call. So I get a chance to work with people who are at least willing enough to go to treatment. And I see a lot of them. And the job is always a big deal. Oh, I can't go to treatment. I'll lose my job. Or I've got to go to treatment because my wife is going to leave me if I don't. And it's all these decisions are wrapped around, you know, what the individual and what he has and what he wants, and it really is a mess. And then every once in a while you get somebody that's just done. They're just done. There's no more play. There's no more game. They're at the end of the jackpot, and they're just like, okay, you know, tell me what to do. And And that's when you've got a really good shot. There's something about alcoholism. We will figure out how not to recover. We'll figure out how to mess up our own recovery. It's inherent in alcoholism. You know, we're not offered the dignity of an accurate self-appraisal as it concerns how much trouble we're in. Mm-hmm. And we think we can manage still. Like who wants to admit that you shouldn't have anything to do with decisions in your life? You know, please, just don't make any more decisions. We'll take care of that. I mean, that goes against everything that we've learned as Americans, you know? Like, never surrender, you know, always be a hero. But to, you know, to get past this alcoholism, we must get to a place where we're thoroughly defeated, because we're just not going to go hop, skipping, and jumping through the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th. It goes counter to our ego. It goes counter to the perception that we have of the world. And it's just not something that we're going to volunteer for unless it means it means our destruction for not doing it. Burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. No person on this earth can stop his recovery from alcohol or prevent his being supplied with whatever is good for him. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean house. Now, the domestic problem. There may be divorce, separation, or just strained relations. When your prospect has made such restitution as he can to his family and has thoroughly explained to them the new principles by which he is living, he should proceed to put those principles into action at home. This is like the last frontier for some of us, you know, we're wonderful in the AA meetings. Then we get home and things change. So we're really being tasked with practice these principles everywhere, you know, not selectively. That is, if he is lucky enough to have a home. Believe me, when I came to, my family was gone 8 years earlier. You know, I drank 8 years after they all left. Though his family be at fault in many respects, he should not be concerned about that. And this is tough, because there's another capacity to alcoholism, and that is we can recognize injustice like with eagle eyes. We can recognize hypocrisy. We can sense insincerity. And the family, here's the true issue. What happens with families is, through constant exposure to active alcoholics, they start to develop really bad skill sets. They start to get sick. I don't know a legitimate treatment center today, long-term treatment, that doesn't have a family component to it, that doesn't drag the family in and tell the family they're sick too. They love hearing that, I gotta tell you. But it's true. It's true. There's been dysfunction has just bred in the family. So we're complete jerks. If all of a sudden we're spiritual and we go through a fifth step and now we're like criticizing the family for not being spiritual. You know, it's just, we got to leave that stuff alone. He should concentrate on his own spiritual demonstration. Let's keep the light shining where it belongs, on us. Argument and fault-finding are to be avoided like leprosy. In many homes, this is a difficult thing to do, but it must be done if any results are to be expected. It must be done. So it's saying argument and fault-finding are to be avoided. They must be avoided. you know, it was a while before I was to the point where I wasn't going to get in an argument with my family. But I don't argue with them anymore. There's not, I haven't had an argument with a family member in a really long time. My wife and I have disagreements, but it's not an argument. It's not like an FU kind of argument. We don't have those. We remain kind of calm, and we're able to talk this stuff out. If persisted in for a few months, the effect on a man's family is sure to be great. The most incompatible people discover they have a basis upon which they can meet. Little by little, the family will see their own defects and admit them. These can be discussed in an atmosphere of helpfulness and friendliness. You know, the difference if you put this stuff into context, the family was really invited into Alcoholics Anonymous. Not into the same room, but they were invited in to the meetings and the gatherings and the fellowshipping. And I don't see that as much today. You know, there's people I've known in AA for 20 years. I've never met their wife. I don't know their kids' names. I've never met their kids. They keep it absolutely separate. Like, I'm going to my AA meeting. And then there are people where I'm friends with their entire family. They've invited me into their life. You know, they used to invite you into their life in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's really a good place where spiritual principles can become better passed on. They'll become infectious. After they have seen tangible results, the family will perhaps want to join in a better way of life. These things will come to pass naturally and in good time, provided, however, the alcoholic continues to demonstrate that he can be sober, considerate, and helpful, regardless of what anyone says or does. Of course, we all fall much below this standard many times, but we must try to repair the damage immediately, lest we pay the penalty by a spree. There's been a few times where I've gotten involved in the family problems, and this is like over 30 years. There's been like two times where I've recognized and judged the family of the individual is so toxic and so poisonous that they probably won't be able to get sober if they stay there. But that's really, really rare, and it's just not. I did such a terrible job managing my own life. I'm not going to try to manage somebody's family or tell them how to manage their family. It just that just doesn't make any sense to me. If there be divorce or separation, there should be no undue haste for the couple to get together. The man should be sure of his ground. The wife should fully understand his new way of life. If their old relationship is to be resumed, it must be on a better basis, since the old one did not work. This means a new attitude and spirit all around. Sometimes it is to the best interest of all concerned that a couple remain apart. Obviously, no rule can be set down. Let the alcoholic continue his new way of life day by day. When the time for living together has come, it will be apparent to both parties. Let no alcoholic say he cannot recover unless he has his family back. This just isn't so. In some cases, the wife will never come back for one reason or another, like in my case. Remind your prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people. It is dependent upon his relationship with God. We have seen men get well whose families have not returned at all. We've seen others slip when the family came back too soon. You want to pick it up?
Sure. So, you know, the thing that kind of shocked me, I think, coming back into the rooms in 2004 and starting to actually spend some time in the big book, was this idea that somehow people weren't involved in recovery. Right? I mean, the book says dependence is on God, not on man. And I kind of like, it was one of those things that I held contemptuously in the back of my head, like, this isn't going to make it for me. You know, this idea that God is everything and God is nothing was reprehensible to me at points, you know, in the first 5 years. I just wasn't going to wrap my head around that baby. You know, and I thought, well, we're doing this, right? I mean, if we're not doing this, and if I don't have a sponsor and he's doing it, right, or if I'm not, you know, but this doesn't make any sense to me. It was all confusing. Didn't make, you know, what the hell? What the hell do you mean people aren't involved? It, you know, it doesn't, you know, I don't like people, right? But they're all around you, right? You can't get rid of them. And, you know, what ends up happening for me is that I start to look at this for what is really being told to me in this book. And I think, you know, Bill and Dr. Bob got this so right. In retrospect, as I look at this, you know, I talk a lot about how it took me 26 years to get with God. And that's the truth, right? But this idea that I can't rely on, you know, individuals to bring about a spiritual experience, that really is kind of, in and of itself, if you think about that sentence, is enough information if I was open to the information, right? Because a spiritual experience is about having a relationship with God, right? Now, I can see you have a relationship with God, which is really cool, right? I can see people be free and having a good time. Whatever your relationship looks like, as long, you know, if you have it with a God of your understanding, that's really very cool, right? But I was always under the impression that the only way this was going to work was if I found a new way to manage and control my life. That it was just simply a modification. There's this company out in Texas where if you send them your car, they'll put like a blower on it and they'll do all this stuff. It's about $45,000 and you get back a car with like 1,000 horsepower, which you can't use except for going from light to light here in New Jersey. You know, and that's what I thought I needed in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I needed a blower, right? A supercharger, right? And I thought there was just something that I needed to fine-tune in my process. See, I knew that I was powerless over alcohol, and then, well, my life was unmanageable when it came to alcohol, but look at all the things I've accomplished. When I came back in 2004, I hadn't had a drink in 2 years. I was miserable, dry alcoholic. I was horrible to be around. My younger children were 6 years old, 5 years old, and they didn't want to be with me. Right, this whole idea about the family structure, right? Whether the family is wrong or not isn't even part of the equation in my head. It's where can I be of service to God and my fellow man? Where can I be of service to my family? Where can I show up today and make an environment of love and tolerance, right? And in the first couple of years of coming back, you know where that was in my house? Me just shutting up, right? That solved so many problems. It was actually frightening, right? If I looked at the evidence of what happened when I shut my mouth in the house, everyone was happier. And I had to think about that for a while because it was disturbing to me. Over the years, the kids kind of came around and, you know, but I also recognized to this day, right, and we're coming up on 15 years, to this day, they still have in place some framework of having how to turn a phrase so the other person's wrong, right? How to make it somebody else's fault that they learned from me, right? It's so ingrained, right? And the idea that they're going to get better overnight just because I'm trying harder, right, just doesn't seem to be the deal, right? I didn't want to recognize, right, the impact that I had on these young individuals as they were growing up around me and seeing Dad act the way that Dad acted, because they looked up to me at the same time that they didn't want to be around me. Crazy, right? Crazy. You know, you bring a bunch of lives into the world and then you treat them poorly, right? What an idea, what a concept. It wasn't my intention, but I was railing against those things around me. But it was in this simple kind of idea that I'll look at the facts, which is what 2004 was for me. Let's take a look at the facts, folks, right? Let's see what's really going on here. And when it was funny, it was like, I've told this story, to, you know, and Chris loves this story, but, you know, when I learned how to do a 10-step, I was probably right around 10 months in 2004. And this whole idea that I wanted to actually have a better home life So I would come home, and the ex-wife would say something, right? Now, my typical response was like, you know, ignore or belittle or whatever my response was, or whatever she heard my response, right? I mean, I was doing the important stuff. I had the important job. You know, raising kids wasn't important. Anybody could do it, right? This is the attitude that I had. So then my 10th step was just be quiet, listen, file away on the shelf what she says and what you think, and then go back if she actually needs some correction to her thought process, right? So she'd say something, and I'd put a little card, I'd write a little 3x5 index card in my head and put it on the shelf, and she'd say something else, and I'd write a little 3x5 index card, put it on the shelf, and, you know, I'd put another little 3x5 index card on the shelf in my head, and, you know, later on, I take them down off the shelf and see what they said, and, you know, they'd be, this is the classic one, you know, sounds like your mother. That'd be the first thing I wrote and put out there. Did you think of that yourself? Right? And then my other favorite was always, when monkeys fly out of my ass, right? That's when I was going to do what she was asking me to do, you know? And these are the things that I thought were additive to the family life. Right? So when I'm working with another person, I want to know about their family. And the funny thing is that there are a lot of families, and there's a lot of alcoholics, who, when you speak to them and you go, so, you know, let's look at your resentment list. You know, and I'll say mom or dad or, who, you know, brother or sister. They're all, you know, they're very often on the first page of the inventory, right? And you go, well, tell me about that. Right? Tell me about what's going on. And they'll tell you. And it's real easy if you spend enough time in this big book, right, and listening to speaker tapes and having honest conversations with newcomers, it's real easy to begin to go, well, if that's true, then is this true also? And you can start to disassemble the lie because I have a close affinity to lying, right? I am like best friends with learning how to lie, right? So I should be able to be helpful in taking apart a lie, right? But what happens when you start to do that with somebody and their family life really is terrible? Right? What do you know? How do you respond to that? That wasn't my experience. My family life was pretty good. And what happens if the family life they describe is nothing like reality? And I've had that happen in inventory too. When I finally kind of got to meet the family, it was completely different. Right? This whole thing is very interesting in the idea that I ever truly know the impact that I have on family. Right? What I potentially did to my mother when I was running around for almost 9 years, you know, like a little mobster, you know, and a drug and alcohol addiction that was through the roof. To this day, I treat her with love and kindness and compassion because I know the nights that she spent awake because of me. None of my children have put me through that. None of my children have to date. But what they have kind of put me through that has kept me awake at night, I really would never want to feel what my mother felt when I was out running around. You know, the car crashes, the police, you know. What did David do now? You know, kind of thing. The damage that we do to families, I don't know if it's ever repairable, but I do know that my actions today can be so aligned with God's will for me that I don't have to create new problems, right? Which is really kind of the gift of this. I forget where we are.
Both you.
Oh, both you. Okay. Both you and the new prospect may one day walk in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen to you. When we look back, we realize that the things we came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better for us than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. All you.
When working with a man and his family, you must take care not to participate in their quarrels. You may spoil your chance of being helpful if you do. But you may urge upon a man's family that he has been a very sick person and should be treated accordingly. You should warn them against arousing resentment or jealousy. You should point out that his defects of character are not going to disappear overnight. Show them that he has entered upon a period of growth. Ask them to remember, when they are impatient, the blessed fact of his sobriety. If you have been successful in solving your own domestic problems, tell the newcomer's family how that was accomplished. One of the things that I think is so cool about Alcoholics Anonymous is we share our experience. A lot of times people share their opinions. That happens. But I think what's of the most value is when we share our experience. Here's what I did. Here's what happened. And I have shared a lot of the things that went on with my family and the recovery of my family or whatever. I share what happened, you know, and I share what I did, the results I got from what I did. I don't share the results of what I didn't do. So in this way, you can set them on the right track without becoming critical of them. The story of how you and your wife settled your difficulties is worth any amount of preaching or criticism. Assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. People have said that we must not go where liquor is served. We must not have it in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must avoid moving pictures which show drinking scenes. We mustn't go into bars. Our friends must hide their bottles if we're to go to their homes. We mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all. Experience proves this is nonsense. There was an enormous amount of bad information that was being spread around the meetings when I first came in. This is the late 80s, early 90s. Enormous amounts of crap information was being spread around. And it came from gazillions of remember I said last week that you couldn't shake a stick without hitting a treatment center. Some of them are good, some of them are bad, but they're the places where a lot of these things, a lot of these sayings, a lot of these sayings would come up. People, places, and things. Mm-hmm. Did you ever hear that? Mm-hmm. People, places, and things. We're going to be exposed to people, places, and things. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. We're going to be hungry, angry, lonely, tired. You can't avoid this stuff. What you can do is work a program of recovery so you can be placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected from alcohol. That's what you can do. And throwing people these one-liners, allows us sometimes to think that that's what will protect us from drinking. You know, people don't go near people, places, and things. Well, let me ask you this: did you ever drink when you were with people, places, and things? Did you ever drink when you weren't with people, places, and things? Did you ever drink when you were hungry, angry, lonely, tired? Did you ever drink when you weren't hungry, angry, lonely, tired? It's not causal. You know what I mean? So a lot of this crap became Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, because everybody was spouting it. I like going back to the big book because this is my truth. This is truth that really, really responds with me. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. There is something the matter with his spiritual status. His only chance for sobriety would be someplace like the Greenland Ice Cap. And even there, an Eskimo might turn up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. Ask any woman who has sent her husband to distant places on the theory he would escape the alcohol problem. We bring the problem with us. You know, we don't escape it. Any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. If the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but he will wind up with a bigger explosion than ever. Here's one of the things that happened with the treatment centers, and still happens with the treatment centers. People go in there and know that they're safe. While they're in there, they're safe from the bottle or the drug, for the most part. You know, I'm going to treatment. The problem is, if there's not a sufficient change in one's spiritual condition, they're going to come out and they're going to be the same person and they're going to relapse. It's what, you know, we have a program of recovery that can get us to a place where spiritually we will be what is termed recovered. And that's the most important thing. It's not shielding. I can go anywhere today. I mean, I've gone into shooting galleries on 12-step calls. You know, I've been at parties where there was drugs and alcohol. None of that stuff fazes me. None of that stuff fazes me. The only thing that is bad is when I'm not there for a good reason. If I'm there just to enjoy the party or something. If I'm there for a business reason, if I'm there for a family reason, you know, if it's somebody's getting married, you know, somebody just died, whatever, and it's a good reason, I don't even tap the brakes with the stuff. It's you know, we get to a place where we are safe and protected, and our spiritual condition is what's going to keep us away from this drugs and alcohol. If the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but will wind up with a bigger explosion than ever. So our rule is not to avoid a place where there is drinking, if we have legitimate reason for being there. That includes bars, nightclubs, dances, receptions, weddings, even plain ordinary whoopee parties. Right? A whoopee party was a drinking party. This is giving us permission to go to drinking parties if we have a legitimate reason to be there. To a person who's had experience with an alcoholic, this may seem like tempting providence, but it isn't. I think we should go over this next paragraph before we end.
Okay.
You'll note that we made an important qualification. Therefore, ask yourself on each occasion, have I any legitimate social, business, or personal reason for going to this place? Am I going to be helpful to anyone there? Could I be more useful or helpful by being somewhere else? If you answer these questions satisfactorily, you need have no apprehension. You may go or stay away, whatever seems best. But be sure you're on solid spiritual ground before you start and that your motive in going is thoroughly good. Do not think of what you will get out of the occasion. Think of what you can bring to it. That's a beautiful spiritual principle that I use for Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I do not think about what I'm going to go get at an AA meeting. I think about what I'm going to go give. Because if you think about what you're going to get all the time, there's a lot of meetings that are going to start to suck, you know. Mm-hmm. But if you're about the business of going to meetings to be of help, every meeting will have some value. Mm-hmm. But if you are spiritually shaky, you'd better work with another alcoholic instead. All right. I guess we'll stop.
Yeah, we have 7 minutes, so we're going to open it up to you guys.